peace for Bosnia, Ireland, and the Middle East. That would be a good Easter present.
Nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
The Pope blessing the crowd of 100,000 people at St. Peter's Square on this Easter Sunday.
Lobby.
It's been a beautiful Easter there. The Pope giving his greeting in 57 languages. Thousands of pilgrims made it to Easter Mass in Jerusalem. People arrived in the old city despite tightened security after the recent bus bomb attacks in Israel. Back in the States, a lot of kids are up now hunting for the hen fruit. There is plenty to go around.
A normal week during the year would involve sales of about 72 million dozen of eggs.
And Purdue University expert Dr. Lee Schrader says Americans buy about 36 million dozen extra eggs right before Easter, so they'll have plenty to paint and put in the baskets. President Clinton will be delivering the eulogy for Ron Brown. The exact funeral plans are not quite set, but the Commerce Secretary, who died in that Croatian plane crash, will be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Brown's casket and those of 32 other American victims were flown this weekend to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The president was there to see them return home. He also comforted the families for several hours. A 747 carrying the Space Shuttle Atlantis had to return to Edwards Air Force Base when an engine warning light came on. The shuttle delayed now, and it may be ferried back to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, but not before this coming Thursday. You're listening to ABC News.
When the Soviets beat the U.S. basketball team in the 72 Olympics, America was outraged. When America's superstar speed skater lost in 92, we were shocked. But when our kids scored 14th in an international mathematics competition, we didn't even notice. America's schools haven't kept pace with the rest of the world. We haven't raised our standards as fast or as far as other countries. As a result, we're losing our ability to compete economically. But it's not too late to turn things around. In some places, it's already beginning to happen. To find out how together we can bring about the kind of improvement we desperately need, call 1-800-96-PROMISE. We'll send you a free booklet outlining how we can keep the promise of a real education for all of America's children and put ourselves back in the lead. A message from the Education Excellence Partnership and the Ad Council.
What's up in the Montana case involving a Unabomb suspect?
Ted Kaczynski remains in the Lewis and Clark County Jail under 24-hour surveillance. The sheriff says he spends most of his time pacing in his cell. FBI investigators say they are only a third of their way through searching his cabin, in part because they are concerned about possible booby traps.
ABC's James Walker in Helena, Montana, says experts have been using a remote-controlled robot to look through Kaczynski's cabin after they found a working bomb in there this weekend. Daylight saving time kicked in overnight through most of the country, so most people had to set their clocks ahead 1 hour to be on time today. He's been on time to the basketball arena for many nights, and it was a record night last night for Robert Parrish. The Charlotte Hornets center played in his 1,561st game in the NBA, and that's one more game than the previous record holder, who happened to be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
It was a great feeling to have broken the record. I've said before, it means a lot to me because of what the record stands for, and that's consistency and longevity, so I'm very proud of the record.
Parrish is 42 years old. He's been in the NBA for 20 seasons now. He did manage to help Charlotte get into the eighth playoff spot, at least for this point. He says he is still amazed, though, overall. Robert Parrish said he had no idea he could ever set such a mark for pro hoops longevity. This is ABC News.
If you wear contact lenses and want factory fresh contacts delivered right to your front door or place of business, call 1-800-800-LENS. AccuView Sequence 2 and other disposables, just $21 a box, plus $6.50 per order for shipping. No hidden costs and no membership fee. For planned replacement, gas permeable, toric, daily wear, extended wear, or fashion tints, call 1-800-800-LENS. That's 1-800-800-5367.
For the ABC Information Network, I'm Dave Barrett.
From ABC News, World News This Week, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Listen.
They seem to have found that Kaczynski is a perfect match, right down to the photograph.
Ron Brown walked and ran and flew through life. And he was a magnificent life force.
The sheriffs just continued to beat him. It was unprovoked.
I am a monster. And something needs to be done to stop me.
Baseball, there's a drive deep to right field. This one is gone! A home run!
The people and events that made headlines when World News This Week continues.
Picture a playground filled with four-year-old children. Picture each face so full of promise. Well, which child deserves to be read to? This one? Or is it that one over there? Which child will get a hot lunch? Who will have a chance to sing? The choice is yours. Volunteer for Head Start. With your help, more low-income preschool children can get what other children already have. Call 1-800-27-START for more information and a brochure on volunteer opportunities with Head Start in your community. Change the world of a child, and you change the world.
Brought to you by Head Start, Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
For 17 years, federal agents have been looking for a needle in a haystack. The needle is a serial bomber. They call him the Unabomber, from his early habits of mailing explosive devices to universities and airlines. The haystack was the entire United States. This week, the search led them to a cabin in the rugged wilds of Montana, where they arrested Theodore John Kaczynski. According to ABC News chief investigative correspondent Brian Ross, they believe the haystack has yielded up its needle.
In this case, they seem to have found that Kaczynski is a perfect match, right down to the photograph. They are now confident they have the right man. They just need the final evidence to go to court and prove it.
The break in the case was a phone call from Kaczynski's younger brother, saying that the family had found some old papers that were strikingly similar to a manifesto the Unabomber had published in the Washington Post last year. By all accounts, Kaczynski was capable of writing such a manifesto. He'd had a brilliant academic career. He was known to reject most of the technological advances of contemporary living. And even in rural Montana, where people tend to mind their own business, he was known as Ted the Hermit. Wendy Gehring lives near Kaczynski's cabin.
We know he's very intelligent, just by the way he speaks. He's real quiet. He's short in conversation. He keeps to himself, and that's about all we knew.
Carol Mon says she saw Kaczynski riding his bicycle every so often.
If I wave to him when I walk by or drive by, he never waves back. He just keeps his head down. Like he doesn't want you to see him.
He was always reclusive, says Kaczynski's Harvard roommate, Patrick McIntosh.
Ted Kaczynski was pretty far out in left field, we all thought. I don't remember more than 10 words he may have spoken directly to me or to anyone else in 3 years.
As it turned out, the FBI had been scouting Kaczynski's cabin for months, camping out in the dead of winter, making sure the hermit had not booby-trapped the woods against the possibility of a raid. After he'd been taken into custody, agents first found a quantity of explosive material in the cabin, enough to file charges against him. Then, as ABC's Bill Greenwood reports, they found a lot more possible evidence.
Hidden in a loft was a carefully wrapped, partially completed pipe bomb, and the FBI found all the ingredients needed to make other explosive devices, including pipes, electrical wiring, and chemicals. Ted Kaczynski's 10 by 12 foot shack was filled with how-to material, including 10 notebooks filled with page after page of information on ways to make and conceal explosive devices.
Also found a typewriter, which experts say is probably the same one that typed the Unabomber's published manifesto. No one has yet formally charged Kaczynski with being the elusive Unabomber, but he has been charged with enough crimes to hold him while the investigation continues. ABC's Greg Jarrett reports on Kaczynski's first court appearance.
Two charges were read against Theodore Kaczynski. The first is possession of a firearm which is not registered in the National Registry of Firearms. Second, that the federal government had reason to believe that Kaczynski was in possession of components with which a destructive device such as a bomb may be constructed. Now, for those who thought that Kaczynski would look like a bomb in court or a hermit, he did not. His hair was neatly trimmed, as was his beard. He spoke in strong tones and stood tall.
Being a former Army man myself, I know what being away from home is like.
So we thought we would bring a little bit of home to you. And there's no better reminder of home than McDonald's. So I hope you enjoy it. I want to thank Tim and his entire McDonald's team. Let's give McDonald's a round of applause.
Those might be the last recorded words of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, doing what Brown did best, leading cheers for American business. Brown and 34 others died this week when a plane carrying them to Croatia crashed into a hillside. Lieutenant General Howell Estes speaks for the Air Force.
The aircraft was on the instrument approach, was in contact with a tower at the Dubrovnik Airport when contact was lost.
Brown's party aboard the plane was a group of senior American business executives. Brown was trying to get them to do business in Bosnia and Croatia, to make investments in the shattered countries now that the war has ended. But as the Reverend Jesse Jackson pointed out, Brown was much more than a politician.
Ron Brown's life is a great American story. So while he grew up in Harlem, the quintessential African-American community and center of black culture, he also went to school at a predominantly white college and thus learned in his formative years to bridge the gap between the cultures.
Indeed, Brown had been a very successful Washington insider before he went to work for the government. A lawyer, a lobbyist, a businessman, and chairman of the Democratic National Committee. In that latter job, he played a key role in the election of Bill Clinton to the presidency, and Mr. Clinton knew it.
He was one of the best advisors and ablest people I ever knew. And he was very, very good at everything he ever did.
The president interrupted his schedule to pay a personal visit to Brown's widow. And later, at the Commerce Department, Mr. Clinton remembered his friend.
His favorite scripture verse was that wonderful verse from Isaiah. They who wait upon the Lord shall have their strength renewed. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and faint not. Well, Ron Brown walked and ran and flew through life, and he was a magnificent life force.
From memorial services for Ron Brown, Mr. Clinton flew to Oklahoma City. It's been nearly a year since a truck bomb exploded in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, killing 169 people, including many children who'd just been dropped off at a daycare center there. Mr. Clinton dedicated a new daycare center, remembered the tiny innocents, and hailed Oklahoma City's efforts to rebuild.
What you have done is to show our children that in the wake of evil, goodness can surround them and lift them up. You have done a lot here already to prove that their lives are strong and powerful.
This week also saw the passing of a pioneer urban leader. Carl Stokes, the first black mayor of a major American city, died of cancer at the age of 68. ABC's Dorothy McIntyre, who worked for several years in Cleveland, remembers the Stokes years.
Carl Stokes overcame a poor childhood in Cleveland. His father died when he was two. His mother then supported the family by working as a maid while on welfare. Stokes dropped out of high school in 1944 and enlisted in the Army, where he served in Germany. Later, he returned to Cleveland, went on to college and law school, and became the first black Democrat elected to the Ohio House of Representatives and the first black mayor of Cleveland. Later, he worked as a TV news anchor in New York and then returned to Cleveland, where he was elected a municipal court judge.
Back to Montana now, where the FBI continued in its efforts to get a group of separatists holed up in a ranch house to surrender. The separatists belong to a loose organization called the Freemen. They've declared the ranch to be an independent township. They've set up their own courts. And they're suspected of issuing millions of dollars worth of phony money. Norman Olson says he leads a similar militia in Michigan and told CBS this week he supports the Freemen.
These people in Montana have given the finger to the federal government, and the federal government can't have that.
Nonsense, say local officials. What the Freemen have really done is threaten the neighbors, cheat business, and harass local officials to the point of desperation. Garfield County Attorney Nick Mernion is delighted to see the feds at the ranch.
This community has welcomed the FBI into this operation. We have one sheriff and one deputy. We were never equipped to deal with a dozen armed men with the ideology that these people have. We have been oppressed by the Freemen and not by the federal government.
Officers allowed various people to enter the ranch. Some were neighbors, some were from law enforcement, and some were relatives of those holed up inside. One visitor was Shannon Niegard.
Everybody's doing fine.
Everybody's normal.
Two delegations apparently conducted formal negotiations with the free men, but as ABC's Barry Serafin reports, nobody reported on the outcome.
No one in any official position is commenting on the talks that have been taking place on the Freeman Ranch. There is no information at all on what they're discussing, although they are believed to be trying to negotiate an end, obviously, to the siege out there.
At week's end, another hopeful sign from Montana. At least two people, a woman and a child, left the ranch and did not return.
Pickup did run or went through the check stop in Temecula and did not stop.
California Highway Patrol Officer Todd Upton was right about that. The battered pickup truck, its cap disintegrating as it drove, led officers in a high-speed freeway chase through Southern California. But when the truck stopped and its cargo of illegal Mexican immigrants fled, that's when the trouble really started. A videotape shows Riverside County Sheriff's deputies hauling the driver and a passenger out of the truck and beating them with nightsticks. Ramona Ripston of the ACLU was outraged.
The sheriff just grabs them and begins to beat them. They weren't fleeing. They were clearly in custody. And the sheriff just continued to beat them. It was unprovoked.
Sheriff spokesman Mark Lohman said the department has suspended the two officers involved.
We saw the same videotape that everybody has seen, and we're embarrassed. I'm not going to pull any punch. I'm going to say we are embarrassed at the actions of our officers that were caught on videotape.
The incident caused an international furor. The Mexican government lodged strong protests and urged those who had been beaten to file lawsuits, which they did to the tune of more than $10 million. Even Congressman Sonny Bono, who represents the area and who has strongly supported efforts to curb illegal immigration, said the officers went too far.
It's unforgivable. There is no reason to beat somebody viciously like that.
But John Barnett, an attorney representing one of the suspended officers, points out that they were in fact pursuing not mere traffic violators, but criminals.
You can see from the tape that this is a high-speed pursuit of felons. These aren't, this isn't the arrest of a Sunday school teacher on her way to midnight mass. These are fleeing felons. And they have to be treated with that in mind.
This is World News This Week from ABC News.
I am a monster. And something needs to be done to stop me.
That's the voice of convicted child molester Larry Don McQuay. McQuay has served 6 years of his sentence, and under Texas law, he is due to be released on parole on Monday. Although McQuay is to be closely monitored during his parole, he says he's likely to molest more children, even kill one. An advocate, Diane Clements, says the law that allows McQuay to roam the streets of San Antonio is an outrage.
Anyone in this state who has a child or doesn't have a child should be quite upset that the fact that this man is going to be on the loose once again.
Alan Polunsky, chairman of the Texas Prison Board, agreed.
I feel it's very unfortunate that Mr. McQuay is being released. Unfortunately, there's nothing the Department of Criminal Justice can do about this particular instance.
McQuay says he wants to be chemically castrated in the hope of curbing his impulse to molest children. But as Dr. Nancy Dickey, chairwoman of the American Medical Association, points out, such a procedure will not help.
The fact that you've removed the hormone testosterone may prevent this person from being able to have an erection, but it doesn't necessarily do away with either the desire for the crime or the violent nature that can still be carried out against children or any other victim.
In another high-profile case, a federal judge who'd thrown out evidence against a confessed cocaine runner, including 80 pounds of cocaine found in her car, has reconsidered his decision, allowing prosecutors to proceed against Carol Bayless. ABC's John Donovan reports that political pressure on Judge Harold Bayless was intense.
Judge Bayer and his unpopular decision had become a political football. Bayer had been appointed by President Clinton. Appointed Bob Dole, the probable Republican nominee for president, had begun to mention. In fact, the White House was not pleased with Bayer's decision either to throw out all that evidence, including a taped confession. The White House had begun to pressure him to reconsider. Now he has.
And this week, the Supreme Court ruled the law means what it says. You can't fire a worker merely for being over 40. Law correspondent Tim O'Brien reports.
56-year-old James O'Connor was fired from his job as a sales rep for a vending machine company in North Carolina and replaced by a 40-year-old. He calls it age discrimination. Federal law specifically protects employees 40 and older from age discrimination, but O'Connor's suit was thrown out by a lower court because he was replaced by someone who the law recognized as older, 40, and within that protected class of workers. Today, the Supreme Court revived O'Connor's lawsuit in an important victory for older workers. The court said the test is whether the employee was fired because of his age, and that the age of the replacement is irrelevant in answering that question.
In Little Rock, federal special prosecutor Kenneth Starr trotted out the closest thing he has to a smoking gun against President Clinton in the ongoing Whitewater case. David Hale, a former banker, municipal judge, and confessed liar, said he'd been pressured by then-Governor Clinton to make an improper loan to James and Susan McDougal. But as Fred Graham of Court TV points out, Hale's testimony is not likely to have long-term implications.
This is the word of a person who is a felon, admittedly. Even if it's believed, it doesn't appear to be a smoking gun against President Clinton in criminal law terms.
Hello, Seattle!
And hello to spring, America, apple pie, motherhood, and baseball.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, your 1995 American League West champion, Seattle
The crowd roared in the Kingdome as the Mariners took the field against the Chicago White Sox in the earliest opening day game ever for Major League Baseball. They roared again as Frank Thomas hit the first home run of the season.
Here's Frank Thomas. Fastball. There's a drive deep to right field. This one is gone. A home run.
Indeed, from the enthusiastic crowds at the nation's ballparks, you'd think all was forgotten and forgiven after last year's baseball strike. After all, said fan Matthew Ives, this is America.
I've never played baseball, but I love to come out to the park. I love to see the green grass. I love to hang out and drink a few beers, and there's nothing better than that.
Baseball's traditional opening game has always been played at Cincinnati, home of the oldest major league team. But this year's first game at Riverfront Stadium was called off just as it began, when home plate umpire John McSherry collapsed and died during the first inning. Reds broadcaster Joe Nuxall commented.
Sad day here at Riverfront on what was to be a cheerful day, the opening of the 96 baseball season, to have it slowed down at this moment because of the very thing that had happened to John McSherry. I think everybody should, we all realize that baseball isn't that serious at the moment.
Reds manager Ray Knight agreed.
I don't know how anybody could have played in that situation. It was just really difficult and hard, and right there before your eyes. The game of baseball is so insignificant to the game of life.
In England, another life and death question, health officials reported that an HIV test given to as many as 20,000 Britons might give false negatives, might falsely report that an infected person was free of disease. Nick Partridge, spokesman for a leading British AIDS charity, says phones have been ringing off the hook.
Going for a test is a traumatic experience. Having to go for a retest is going to be really difficult for many people. But there should be reassurance that the actual number of false negatives is going to be very low.
An interesting ruling from New York State's highest court on the subject of assisted suicide this week. The state's Court of Appeals struck down New York's law against the practice, saying that doctors may prescribe drugs that would help mentally competent but dying patients end their own lives. Attorney Carla Kerr, who represented three doctors charged with assisted suicide, praised the ruling.
Win or lose, all of these cases have raised the consciousness of Americans as to how they would want themselves and their loved ones to be treated at the end of their lives.
The man most closely associated with the assisted suicide issue is, of course, Dr. Jack Kevorkian. This week, Kevorkian was again in court charged under common law with assisting a suicide. The so-called Dr. Death showed up for trial dressed in a colonial costume, complete with powdered wig, and told reporters why.
I have nothing but contempt for this whole proceeding, for the courts and everybody else that engineered it. Nothing but contempt.
Kevorkian was being tried under the common law, which dates back to medieval times because Michigan's assisted suicide law has expired. But by week's end, a Michigan Court of Appeals ruling had forced the postponement of proceedings against Kevorkian. ABC's Tom Corbett explains.
It's a decision that could give Kevorkian's legal battle a whole new complexion. The ruling from the Michigan Court of Appeals says in order to convict him, prosecutors must prove that Jack Kevorkian intended that two patients actually commit suicide. The issue of Kevorkian's intent has been a pivotal one in both his second and third assisted suicide trials, and this decision is seen as a victory for Kevorkian's defense.
News in the nation's economy was good this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average posted its usual all-time highs. Real estate salesmen in most parts of the country reported a healthy influx of spring home buyers, and the numbers crunchers said inflation is holding steady. Unemployment statistics for March also were healthy. Although the Labor Department's monthly index was up a tick, the government also reported a significant increase in the actual number of jobs in the books. Economist Robert Dieterich of Chicago's Northern Trust Company says the future is promising.
What we've had is the Federal Reserve tried to slow the economy. It did so successfully. It did not generate a recession. It did generate a slowdown. And now there are signs that the slowdown is in its last stages and the economy is gathering a little speed.
You know that sound, or something like it, the sound of a cash machine forking over a crisp new $20 bill. This week, two national cash machine networks and several regional ones announced they would allow a surcharge on transactions involving their systems. If you withdrew cash from a machine belonging to a bank other than the one where your account is, you might be charged twice for the convenience. Congressman Charles Schumer cried foul.
This amounts to a secret double whammy on every person who goes over and uses one of these bank machines.
But Scott Strug, vice president for marketing for one regional ATM network, said the surcharges are fair.
The reason for them, basically, is there are some ATMs in unique locations, such as airports or hotel lobbies, that are costly to maintain. And this allows the owners to actually turn a profit from those.
Some see it as the natural end of winter, the last college basketball game of the season, enthusiastically played this week at New Jersey's Meadowlands. When it was all over, Kentucky's Wildcats were the NCAA champions, 76-67 over Syracuse. Some more signs of the times when world news this week continues.
Let's say you're sitting in your car at a stoplight, and out of the corner of your eye you see two guys. By the time you turn your head, they've got a gun pointed at your face. They want your car. Not because they like your car. They're not going to enjoy the rack and pinion steering and fine leather seats like you did. No, they're going to cut up your car for parts and sell it off. They want the money to buy drugs. They don't care that this car was a part of you, that you'd park it way away at the mall so you don't get any door dings on it. No, all they want to do is take it, sell it, and use the money to buy drugs. But we don't have to live like this. Together we can change things. Together we can get drugs off our streets and make our neighborhoods safe to drive through again. But if we sit on our hands and do nothing, nothing will change. So call 1-800-544-5011 and find out what you can do to help in your neighborhood. Because together, we can get things straightened out around here. Call 1-800-544-5011.
A call to action from the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Yes, it's time. Time to set your clocks ahead an hour in most of the country. Time to replace your smoke alarm batteries. More important, time to plant the fields. This week, President Clinton signed the Farm Bill, which removes a lot of crop controls as well as a lot of price supports. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman says it's almost a revolutionary time for American farmers.
Farmers finally will be free to plant for the market, not for the government.
Of course, time is one thing, and its first cousin, weather, is something else entirely. As we pulled our Easter bonnets from the shelves, watched the crocuses pop up in our front yards, packed away the warm winter woolies, Charles Gustafson at the Big Powderhorn Mountain Ski Resort in Michigan reminded us there's still time for a trip down the slopes.
That's beautiful. They're grooming the hill. The hill is in perfect shape. So come out skiing.
And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Stu Chamberlain. I'm Chuck Sievertson, ABC News, New York.
This has been a presentation of ABC News. More Americans get their news from ABC News than from any other source.
From ABC News, I'm Dave Barrett. Easter morning.
And there might be snow bunnies hopping around New York City. The threat of a couple inches of snow out there today, along with the churchgoers.
Well, it's about par for this winter. I don't like it.
Celeste Wiseman on the way to St. Patrick's Cathedral.
You're going
to
pray for better weather?
You better believe it.
A sunny day at the Vatican. Bells rang and the Pope gave his Easter greetings to a huge crowd that gathered at St. Peter's Square, and his message keyed in on peace.
The Pope asked Jesus Christ to guide those who, at the cost of great sacrifices, are building peace every day and in every corner of the globe, and especially in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Ireland, and the Middle East.
ABC's Wolf Ochner in Rome. Easter for the peacekeepers. They held an open-air service for U.S. troops in Tuzla, Bosnia. It's pretty nice there, in the upper 50s, with sunny skies in Bosnia. The meaning of Easter? Well, for some in Britain, some have wavering faith.
A survey of 1,500 people conducted last month found that half believe Christ rose from the dead, while a third do not. A separate poll found an even higher number of believers. However, more debate is sure to follow. A biblical scholar is set to publish a paper this week claiming Christ's appearance to his followers after the crucifixion was a collective delusion. Kate Bowie, ABC News, London.
Not going up, not yet. The shuttle Atlantis, it was to be airlifted aboard a 747 from California to Florida this weekend, but there was an engine warning light and it glowed on the jumbo jet. That meant a turnaround just after takeoff. They had to go back to Edwards Air Force Base. NASA is going to try and get its orbiter back to home base at the Kennedy Space Center. They won't be able to do that, though, before Thursday. You're listening to ABC News.
Let's say you're sitting in your car at a stoplight, and out of the corner of your eye you see two guys. By the time you turn your head, they've got a gun pointed at your face. They want your car. Not because they like your car. They're not going to enjoy the rack and pinion steering and fine leather seats like you did. No, they're going to cut up your car for parts and sell it off. They want the money to buy drugs. They don't care that this car was a part of you, that you'd park it way away at the mall so you don't get any door dings on it. No, all they want to do is take it, sell it, and use the money to buy drugs. But we don't have to live like this. Together we can change things. Together we can get drugs off our streets and make our neighborhoods safe to drive through again. But if we sit on our hands and do nothing, nothing will change. So call 1-800-544-5011 and find out what you can do to help in your neighborhood. Because together, we can get things straightened out around here. Call 1-800-544-5011.
A call to action from the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Check the 35,000 words written by the Unabomber, the manifesto, which was published last year by the New York Times and the Washington Post.
The publication of the manifesto was the single thing that brought this case to a close.
Brian Duffy is with U.S. News and World Report, and he says there was a link between the manifesto and what Ted Kaczynski wrote in letters found at his mom's place in suburban Chicago.
In the letter to his mother from an earlier date, he used a phrase, well, comma, we can't eat our cake and have it too. Well, in paragraph 185 of the Unabomber Manifesto, he uses the exact same language.
Kaczynski could be charged within 10 days. Most of us woke up with clocks set an hour ahead as daylight saving time kicks in, but the effects of the time change may mean fatigue, especially if you're driving. So
try to get as good a night's sleep on Sunday night, and I would even suggest possibly a short nap sometime on Sunday.
And that's to overcome what tends to be a 7% hike in car accidents on the first Monday after daylight saving time starts. Barry Swedler with that advice. He's with the National Transportation Safety Board and says if you're driving and you're drowsy, just pull over for 20 minutes or so. This is ABC News.